The Lab takes the ethereal to the practical. Our podcast acts like a business school case study for private equity professionals, CEOs, operating partners, and chief transformational officers. We all know transformation is the key to differentiated alpha. Here's how you actually do it. Our audience tunes in to learn from those in the field, getting their fingernails dirty and driving meaningful growth through better operations, technology, and data. We learn from going to business school, teaching at business schools, and applying these lessons in the real world that case studies actually help the insight stick better. Come join us.
All right. Well, welcome to the next episode of The Lab here. We've got Paul with us today. Paul and I have known each other for a while, and we sort of dug in on value creation, and that seems to fit perfectly because that's the mandate of The Lab here in this podcast of creating value. So, you know, maybe what we'll start off with, Paul, is with your background, worrying about things in a nuclear submarine is very different than worrying about the value creation of the, you know, trying to get the margin up by an extra couple pips. So, you know, starting with an urgency there sort of seems to me is set the foundation of what we've talked about is creating value in companies and the urgency in which to create that value, right? So maybe we start with that before I dig into a couple of questions, because, you know, one of the things around urgency is focused on, you've used this analogy in our conversations. If you have to launch 10 arrows and you got 60 seconds, you can't sit around thinking about it for 30 seconds because you're already behind the eight ball. Yet you can't be irresponsible and just start shooting, you know, willy-nilly. So we'd love to get your thoughts around being consistent and precise about operational management and driving value early in the life cycle of a business.
Yeah. So, you know, in a good operating group that's aligned with the investment team, the operating team will be along for the diligence process as well, right? And as you're taking an outside and look at these assets, you want to come up with a value creation plan in conjunction with the deal team that, you know, if what you want to do when things go well, and then what levers you have to pull to keep optionality in case things go wrongly, right? So that way, I don't want to call it a break glass in case of emergency plan, but you always want to have a couple tools in your toolkit in case the market doesn't grow the way you want to grow, in case you can't shake loose any organic growth. You know, if that way you always have a backup plan and can return value to your stakeholders.
Yeah, well, I mean, let's talk about that, because I think part of it is so oftentimes people get so excited to do a deal and they do it. Congratulations, you win, it's yours. And all of a sudden you say, all right, we have a plan. And by definition, every model that we've ever built, every sort of plan by definition is wrong because it's static. So you need that flexibility. Another one of your sayings we love is like, you know, God forbid you're in a restaurant and you go to the, you know, restroom or something and your child's choking. Do you have to go ask me for permission to give my kid the Heimlich? Like, no, like, what's the plan? So how do you think about in the three stages of the life cycle of a deal? Stage one, what are we going to buy? What should we buy? Fine. Stage two, we've identified the asset. Do we want to own it? Stage three, we own it. Now we better go do what we said we're going to do and have that flexibility to go left, right, up or down as needed. How would, you know, what's your advice? Because this is sort of like a, you know, case study sort of scenario. How have you done that? And how do you think about that? And what's worked for you so others can, you know, not stub their toe as often as otherwise may happen?
Yeah. So the first thing you have to get established is an onboarding process. And another metaphor I use is when you go to look at somebody's, like when you go over to somebody's house, you don't start rearranging the furniture day one. Right. You go over there, you meet them, you get to know them. You see, you go on some ride alongs with the sales team. You go walk the factory floor. You break bread with the executives. You get to know them. Right. And then so, you know, first 100 days, you hear this thing in private equity value creation, a lot of 100-day plan. I actually don't like 100-day plans. I want to take 100 days and just observe and do the real diligence. Right. Because in the context of banker led processes, right, you don't get as much information as you used to get a few years ago. Right. So that said, I have a checklist of stuff with the ride-alongs and getting more information and understanding why this business exists the way it does before we go in and start pulling some levers. During that time, what I do want to do is set up what I'll call the governance structure, you know, the monthly financial reporting, the operating committee. This becomes the heartbeat of the business, right? So every month you have engagement point with the management team, thump, thump. And that way, and it becomes very standardized and very deliberate. sometimes, right, over communicating with the management team, has time to have time to work, right? So over communicating with them at ad hoc intervals isn't exactly most helpful. But when you set this governance up, it's an engagement point. And then if things go well, you're just monitoring and then, you know, applying resources. And then if things, you know, don't turn out as well, you've already got a healthy place to have these dialogues around.
I love the governance. We do that in almost all of our deals, because what you notice is the C-level executives break away. They're operating, they're driving the business forward. They're not in the day-to-day weeds, right? And you need to kind of bring them back and have a level set and say, hey, this is what we decided we were doing together, right? Are we still seeing eye to eye? And it's kind of the checkpoint for alignment, right? And yep. And it's really important. What's the most challenging point? You know, we touched on it yesterday in our prep session. You mentioned you're going from courting to owning, and that can be a bit of a delicate handoff, right? And then there's value creation almost immediately. Where do you see areas that folks can do it better, or where have you had the most success?
Where things can go wrong if the management team and the private equity firm have a misalignment on the purpose of that relationship. So one of the things I like to do during the onboarding session is actually just lay it on the table. Why are we here for? Most of the management teams think that private equity firms are just a source of capital. In today's environment, you know, it's also a source of capital, it's a source of customers, and it's a source of capabilities, right? So, you know, as a business that's growing, it's going to need more and different capabilities. And as the org matures, you're going to need more and different capabilities. One of the first things I like to do is add a chief of staff to every single business, right? Typical conversation, me and the CEO, because the SG&A usually gets starved the year before sales process. It's, you know, hey, Mr. CEO, I think you need a chief of staff, right? And that'll also bolt into the governance process, right? And help, you know, keep the pipes flowing. We need to get things done, right? So I'd be shoring up what the role of each person on the board, of each executive, and then getting a good value creation plan aligned on, inked. I actually love printing out value creation plans and signing them as a group, just some sort of a spiritual magic to it, right? And then you revisit the plan, and then you keep the goals the same, the underwriting goals. And if you have to change the plan, you change the plan.
I love it. From your perspective, maybe it's more anecdotally, but are you seeing a shift and an embrace from PE shops to think like this? Because when I first started here 6-7 years ago, value creation was talked about, but not necessarily prioritized. Now, especially in, you know, as companies have beefed up operations teams and as deal flow has stalled a little bit, at least, it's front center, right? So is there a bit of an embrace from your perspective?
So it's evolved a bit, right? In 2012 to 2020, there was a lot of multiple expansion, right? So there were deals that got underwritten that, you know, might not have worked without multiple expansion, right? And so now you're seeing PE firms underwrite multiple contraction. You're seeing dedicated operating resources around specific capabilities like pricing. You know, we always saw the procurement guy that was bumping around as much as 10 years ago. Now there's specific pricing team members. I had a digital transformation person on my team, right? There's just all these core capabilities, because one of the things they're finding out is when you know, you can always outsource these capabilities to a consulting firm, but it's nice to have somebody that's going to be along for the ride for 2, 3, 4, 5 years, right? And in the context of lower deal flow, you're getting longer holds. And in longer holds, you're going to have to move the needle operationally and transformatively to get investor returns.
Well, if there's a bright line that's in the sand here, that's like before you buy a company and then once you buy a company. So before you buy a company, it's how do you think about it? Like a 100-day plan, even though we may not like that term, is written once you own it. Well, guess what? You already own it. So you paid whatever you paid for it, and maybe you should or maybe you shouldn't have paid as much, but you lift up that hood and you say, my goodness, the engine is not what I was sold, right? So you got to think about before you buy. And then to your point, once you do own it, having someone like a chief of staff is interesting. We've done more and more of those roles. I'd be curious what you think the right makeup is of that person, because often it could be a way for someone who wants to get into a PE-backed role that hasn't been PE-backed, but really knows the industry, or maybe it's someone who's transitioning to a different industry that's already had some PE experience. So I'd love to get your take on, you know, to the proverbial left of the start line, the proverbial right of the start line. How do you make sure you're doing it the right way?
Yes, I heard two things. It's what do you plan for before? It's I've got, you know, 15 things I'd like to do if I had a magic wand, right? Attribute. Number one, I would, you know, I would get in with the team and spend a week doing an operations diagnostic and looking at all my, you know, how I could improve procurement and supply chain and manufacturing. Number two, I would do a talent assessment, right? And I'd look at what are the holes in the organization and what should we fill those with? And it's not just talent statically, it's talent. What kind of talent do we need to double EBITDA? Right? Because that's a different discussion than statically what gaps there are in the organization or what opportunities there are. Right? And then the third thing is I'd want to have an offsite strategy session at that, about that 90 day point. Right? And if you, and there's probably seven or eight other things we could add to that. But if I, you're not going to likely get all of those things because we go back to that point, you know, we can't swarm the management team. They've got a day job and a business to run. But if you zero into that chief of staff, if I could only put one thing, and sometimes I call it a chief of staff, sometimes I call it a chief transformation officer at a bigger company, sometimes I call it a VP of transformation, right? The key, that to me is the best role you can get if you're coming out of a consulting firm, if you're coming out, I've done it well with someone coming out of the military that's now a business unit president after only 4 or 5 years. That role becomes the linchpin for the CEO to drive value above and beyond the day-to-day operations, right? So that keeps flowing when the customer complaints come in and the new product commercializations come in. It keeps the strategic initiatives on track. To give you a quick example, at my old shop, I staffed this gentleman into the role of chief of staff. And he started out as a chief of staff role. There was like a PMO, whatever you want to call it, and a right-hand person to the CEO. Within 6 months, that had morphed into, hey, we need a VP of operations quality role. And he stepped up into that, you know, with, you know, 3 more months in. You know, that person was so immersed, like that person was so immersed in the business that even though they came back to us for a couple years, they went into the asset as a business unit president of the whole West Coast region, right? And then went from chief of staff to running a $300 million P&L. There's no better way to learn these businesses than being immersed in them. And those capabilities are things that usually middle market companies for sure haven't seen, right? The, you know, candidly, the CEO was, he was a little puzzled why we wanted to do this and why it was so important. But then 3 months later, he's like, I'm going to chain him to his desk, right? Cause he's never leaving. He's never going back to the mothership, right? And so thinking about talent, short-term, long-term, getting all these things done, right? That's how you get, you know, you build the relationship between the P firm and the asset, right? And then, you know, it helped me, you know, one of the partners at McKinsey told me, he's like, don't ask your clients if you need help, just go help them, right? And that's kind of the role I took at working as an operating partner is how do I actually help the assets, right? It's not just monitoring compliance and checking and gap assessments and investment committee reports. It's helping these businesses do what they do better and do it more effectively in the context of growth.
Yeah, we double click on that. I think there's a cynical side to this that means it's economic, and then there's a value creation side. I agree. I often hear a CEO say, why do I need this person? Right? And the P firms love it because operating partners are super valuable, but they're part of the GP. So if you have a chief of staff or a chief transformation officer, right, when I think about it, right? Guess who's paying for that? It's the portfolio company. Lovely. So that talent is deep in there and they're really focused on creating value. And they're not viewed as like a sneaky spy who's trying to be, you know, sort of really reporting to the P firm. These chief of staff roles are deep in there. And so, yep. And they're being thoughtful about KPIs and dashboards and sort of windshield looking on how to create value, not rear view mirror looking on how to create value. So I agree with you. It's a very interesting role. And most consultants are, you know, they're great consultants, but they want to get out of being consultant and they want to jump into being in a, you know, PE-backed asset, make equity, not just base and bonus. So you're right. We've seen more and more of that. And you got to find someone who then can use that role to jump into what's your next step. You can be in the C-suite. You can, right? Because you've been the number two effectively, and you can dip into different things, or you can go and be an operating partner. But it's giving you it's hard to put someone who came straight from consulting into an operating partner role because they haven't, you know, actually had to live in an asset and succeeded and failed based on the plan.
I totally agree. I did it backwards. I worked in operating roles and then went to consulting and then went to the operating partner role. And it's the operating partner role is tough to hire for because you have to work at a board level. And then when things get messy, you have to go down and sometimes write a project charter, which not everybody wants to do once they're seniors.
Mm-hmm.
We did this interview a little differently than typical. We usually start with, who are you and what do you do? I like how we jumped right in, but let's retrace our steps a little bit. Tell us about the Sweeney Group operating system that you're deploying now and give us an example of where it's worked, because I know you have five core principles that you lean on for value creation. I'd love to hear about that.
Yeah. So we are, a boutique advisory and investment firm in 2022. I've worked in a variety of roles, I've worked everywhere from big oil to distribution to running a chemical business to a variety of things in consulting. And, I've figured out there's basically five principles for value creation at an asset. I used to think about operations just as kind of efficiencies and metrics and KPIs, but, spending time in private equity, the only thing that matters is exits, right? That's all that matters, right? So, kind of the five things that we think about are, how do we make sure interests are aligned? Right. And that's incentive packages for the management team and engagement points and connectivity, on the front end side that the PE firm has a disciplined investment approach. Right. There was a bit of fervor in the market leading up to the pandemic. Right. And it's make sure you have optionality and have those underwritten value creation plans. And quite frankly, the backup plans that we referred to earlier. But the third thing is active ownership and governance. Right. It's that. We have an investment that locked up now and pretty much the entire management presentation. It was like, you're going to have 1.5 of my team members here with you on the ground. And if that's not comfortable for you, that we're probably not the partner for you, messaging that. And so that they know it's going to be active ownerships, right? The fourth thing is a long-term perspective, right? The advantage of being in private equity is, you can hold an asset for 5 to 7 years. And then some of the newer products, that you can hold in perpetuity or hold for 20 years. I have 20-year funds. That way you can make decisions like adding an ERP system if you need it, right? You're not focused on just in and out. And then the last thing is a risk management approach, right? I'm always thinking about risk, whether it's a safety or recontracting or raw material suppliers or pen stroke risk, right? Like I'm obsessed with, because those are the things that will turn a 3x exit into like a 2x exit very, very quickly if you don't optimize for solving those.
And there's lots of, that's all high level stuff and important to focus on the specifics. What do you think is one of the things that maybe people forget how difficult it is? Like if you could go back and say, I don't know, like plant consolidation, whatever it is, like what have you seen that you say, that's sort of a third rail. Let's avoid situations like that.
So to hit your plant consolidation during diligence, there's a lot of things that look very good in math are much harder to execute than you would expect, right? I've never had a plant consolidation. I'm an industrials guy through and through. I've never had a plant consolidation go great. I've had one go okay, because like you're literally unbolting factory equipment, tearing it down, putting in semi trucks, driving it across the country. It just takes a while to work. If you haven't built inventory, your customers are destined to scream at you. One of the assets I worked at 7 or 8 years ago had a failed plant consolidation. They merged, 15-ish production lines into a site with 65 and built a 3 or 4 month backlog, right? And it was me and some colleagues of mine that were external digging that out for like 9 months, right? And it was the things that are hard to do is the daily discipline, right? It was us. I put my plant manager hat back on. It was us at the shift huddles at 6 a.m. I was there twice a week. They were there four or five days a week, literally directing traffic in a million square foot manufacturing site. And it's just brutally painful. Not everybody's willing to do that, right? It's a 5 a.m. wake up, in perpetuity. I got to know the Courtyard Marriott there very, very well. And they're lovely runny eggs.
Yeah, well, it was a good status when you're, the elite Courtyard Marriott status. It's similar to aviation status or whatever, right? But it's different. Yeah, and the reason I like that story is that, similar to what, we're trying to be thoughtful about, just because it looks good in the Excel spreadsheet doesn't necessarily mean it's going to work, right? And I think that comes back to having an operational mindset to say, at X, I learned this, and why I learned this, and I'm going to bring that to bear on this new opportunity. And I think that's the way that the operational insight can drive better sort of value creation earlier on before you buy it. Because one of the great things that we can help firms do is avoid broken deal costs. Like if you're going to get to know, let's get to know quick, as opposed to, I don't know, maybe it looks good and it's pretty. So, having that operational insight is just so important.
Yeah. So that's, you know, and everybody has to find their niche, right? Like my digital transformation guy was at one of the big consulting firms, and he'd done like 30 major programs, which is no small feat, right? And he can have the pattern recognition to go in there and during the assessment process, suss out, you know, 5, 10, 15 things you could possibly do. I've been to 200 factories, right? And those start connecting the dots before I can tell you with a 2-hour plant walk about what their operating efficiency is at, plus or minus 5 points. I could tell you how much they could get it up to just based on the process type. And then that's an interesting plug into the model. And to your point earlier, all models are wrong, but some are very, very useful. And given that context, right, like having better informed diligence process will definitely lead to better investment outcomes. My old partner taught me that optionality is everything. I've already said this point. Like you want to, if it doesn't grow at GDP growth, you want to be able to buy your way out of it with acquisitions. If that doesn't work, you want to be able to take some cost out, right? If that doesn't work, carve something out and bolt it to it. Just as long as you have some, if you take single product brand risk and it doesn't hit, you're in trouble.
Mm-hmm. Well, listen, I think that's one of the great things about what we've enjoyed working with you is sort of bringing that to bear. And I think that's what you've been doing on behalf of companies that you own and PE firms that you're working with and whatnot. And so, you know, it's been great to sort of be able to work with you. I think the listeners will find, you know, your insights around creating value earlier and having optionality and having sort of, you know, a plan that, you know, it's going to go wrong at some point unless you're very lucky. And, you know, maybe that's more like, you know, Nick and his reality, but the rest of us, you know, we have to figure things out once in a while. So it's great to have you on the podcast and talk through that.
Nice sitting down with you guys. If I can make a shameless plug, paulswaney.com, SWANEY.com or www.swaneygroup.com.
Awesome. Excellent.
Well, thanks for joining us, guys.
Talk soon. See you guys. Bye.
Hope you guys enjoyed that. It was nice talking to Paul, for one, Navy guy. You know, I like my Navy guys because I was a Navy guy. I should clarify that for the folks saying, why is he saying that? Scott, one thing that jumped out to me, and I like this, Paul kind of framing it up. Look, diligence is important. 100 days is important. Post 100 days, uber important. I like the chief of staff, or I think you place some CXs or chief transformation officers. How early are you guys getting them involved? Where do you see the best bang for your buck as far as how quickly to get them involved? I haven't really heard about putting them in and really immersing them pre-close, but it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, well, I think part of the pre-close is using a executive who, you know, used to run the business or one of the comps, but is now doing something different. So they're super deep on the asset. Not the industry necessarily only, but the asset in question, but not conflicted, right? So you can do that day negative 70 or whatever it is and sort of build. But then once you own it, the faster, you know, you can start implementing what you said you're going to do, because you almost have like a get out of jail free time period for the first couple of months when everyone's like, all right, we're owned by PE firm A. We expect some change. And part of that change is, all right, we have a chief of staff or a chief transformation officer, someone who's in the weeds. And, you know, the management team at first is like, I don't know if I need this person. But, you know, as Paul said, and we see this dozens of times, they're like, whoa, I didn't know that this existed. This sort of leverage is amazing because now I, CEO, can go and run this business and I don't have to deal with the, you know, sometimes the pain points are being stuck in the mud with dealing, quote unquote, with all the demands of a private equity firm and the KPIs and the sort of the, you know, dashboards. Great. Let's have the chief of staff do it. And then, you know, they're getting input from the CEO, but that person is driving a lot of that grinding. So it's been proven time and time again to be helpful.
Yeah. And I think another thing, we've heard this a couple times now, is the PE firm is more than just a bank account, right? It's more than a check. They are really looking, especially as the market gets more and more competitive, to be a value add throughout the entirety of the hold period. And they are differentiating by how they support the C-level. So it's, again, you're placing a ton of these folks that are doing that. It's cool to see Paul's perspective and how he leans into that, because again, it's all about operational excellence and differentiating alpha, et cetera.
Yeah, that's right. I think it's great to have more and more case studies of how that works. And, you know, Paul's everyone's got different backgrounds and different styles and whatnot. He's just another example of someone who said this. He's a no-nonsense guy, because you love your Navy guys, right? As you said, you know, his problems on a nuclear sub are way different than the problems of someone who, you know, career in, you know, the halls of an investment bank and sort of grinding through models. Important stuff, but very different, right? And so he got to the same conclusion that we've all gotten to, which is operations are sort of so important to the value creation model. So, you know, he's been fun to work with, and he's created some really nice wins for his PE partners, and glad to have him on this episode.
Cool. Well, look, we are starting to bank some episodes, folks. We're excited to get a episode out every couple of weeks at this point, and hopefully you enjoyed that, and we'll bring you some other unique perspective coming up next.
All right. Thanks.